Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, yes, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking about foster care and adoption with a local Maryland fellow, Rob Scheer. Rob is the founder of Comfort Cases, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to bring dignity and hope to youth in foster care through comfort, community, character, and compassion. Rob and his partner, Reese Scheer, are the proud fathers of five children from the foster care system who arrived at their home with trash bags. Growing up in foster care himself, Rob remembered feeling disposable as a child, carrying a trash bag to his foster home, and he wondered how this could still be happening 30 years later. In 2013, the Scheer family set out on a mission to eliminate the use of trash bags in the foster care system and provide children entering the system with brand new essential and comfort items. To date, Comfort Cases has impacted over 150,000 children in the foster care system. Rob is the CEO of Comfort Cases, and he travels the country to share his story and advocate for youth in foster care. He published his memoir in 2018, A Forever Family, Fostering Change One Child at a Time. Reese cares for their five children at home. They live on a farm in Darnestown, Maryland, with two cats, two dogs, a bird, three goats, several chickens and ducks, and a pig named Penelope. I hope, Rob, that I didn't miss any animals or any other beings.
You know, I love that. First of all, thank you so much for having me, David.
I'm so excited to have you on.
I am so, so excited. You know, it's funny when I talk about living on a farm, you know, I was a kid who grew up, you know, right outside of D.C. I mean, farm life was not something for me. It wasn't something that I ever expected. And it was, oh my gosh, it was 10 years ago. My son, Makai, he arrived in my home at the age of two. And when he arrived in our home, we were told he was never going to walk and that he probably would never talk. And are we sure we want this one? As if he was a piece of clothing when they handed us his trash bag. And I'll never forget that evening when he arrived, and, you know, the looking into this little boy's eyes and could see that he had already been beaten down by this time at the age of two with no hope. And to bring him in our home with a trash bag. But what happens is, you know, we go through the legal system to adoption. And finally, after we were able to adopt Makai when he was about 4 years old, my husband and I were finally able to take him to a decent doctor, because, you know, we can get into all that when it comes to medical, when it comes to kids in foster care. And we found out that Makai had FAS. He has fetal alcohol syndrome. So they were like labeling him as autistic and all of these other things that we were researching and finding out that just wasn't the case. And we found out after doing brain scans that his frontal lobe was not developed and that he suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome. So we immediately dove into what was FAS and, you know, what do you do to help a child with fetal alcohol syndrome? And I am not kidding you. I'm a banker by trade, and I came home from a business trip and walked into my house, and my husband says to me, "You've got to read this article." And I read this article, and it's about a little girl in foster care who also had fetal alcohol syndrome, and that she was put with a family who had a farm, and that the foster family really noticed all of a sudden this girl started, you know, blossoming. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was like, this article is crazy. And I looked at Reese and he says, "Here's five farms for sale." And we literally sold our home. We bought a farm. Within the first week of moving into our home, we got goats and chickens and ducks. We read as many books as we could about being farmers. As I always say, I'm a goat farmer. But let me tell you something. My son, Makai, is 15 years old now. He is a ninth grader. He is an honor roll student. He walks, he runs, he talks, he loves. Children are resilient. And we call him our chicken whisperer because normally he has a chicken under his arm. But yeah, that's how I live on a farm, my
friend.
That
is awesome. That is just awesome. Now, tell us a little bit about your background in the foster care system personally. And I want to talk to you about the farm and your kids, and I want to talk more about your involvement with the system, whether it's here in Maryland or elsewhere. But tell us about your own personal experience having been in foster care as a child.
You know, for me, I'm the youngest of 10 kids. My mother had been married 6 times. She had 10 children. We were in and out of every shelter in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. I don't remember a picture on the wall. I don't remember a Christmas tree. I don't remember a birthday cake. And I definitely don't remember her looking at me and saying, I love you. But she just continued to keep going to men that continued to beat her and beat us kids. And it was bad. And my brothers and sisters were already starting to be pulled out of the house and put into the system. And it's crazy how the system, you know, back in the 70s, it hasn't changed. And so, you know, they will take 2 kids out of the house because those kids were neglected and abused, but they would leave my sisters and I, even though, you know, there was obvious markings on us that we were also being abused. I mean, my father used to put cigarettes out on our legs and you know, because we didn't grab him his Pabst Blue Ribbon fast enough. And then 12 years old, I turned 12 and my parents died. And it was, wow. I was like, wow, I'm finally going to be alive. I'm not going to be starved anymore. I'm not going to be beat anymore. I'm going to be loved because I'm going into foster care and going and living with, you know, someone who is, you know, just basically a stranger was better than what I was living there now. And so I
was Rob, let me ask you, was there any other family after your parents passed? There was no other family in the area for you and your sisters?
You know, the saddest part about foster care is, you know, David, everybody has family. Let's just understand that. Okay.
Yeah.
Everyone has family. It's whether or not the system does anything to step up to help find that family. Okay. So, you know, I had aunts and uncles and cousins, and, you know, they were probably just as dysfunctional as my birth parents were, but no one ever stepped up. And, you know, it wasn't until I, you know, was in my 30s when all of a sudden family members, you know, when I first did my first TV show, all of a sudden family members just started falling out of the woodwork and, oh, if we only knew, if we only, but yeah, there was no family, but I went to my first home and I carried a trash bag.
Were you with your sister? Did your sisters go with you or did they go elsewhere?
No. Yeah. See, let me tell you something. The myth that families, they want to keep families together is a myth. They want to do everything they possibly can in the system to make their job easier. And so it's a lot easier to split children up than it is to, you know, keep children together. So no. Right. And by the way, you have to also understand, my brothers and sisters, by the time I was 12 years old, they were already fallen to the wayside. They were already the statistics that we see today within our system. There was drug overdose. There was incarceration. There was teenage pregnancy. You know, there was drug addiction. There was psychological institution. So, I mean, all of the things that come with, you know, kids with trauma and kids that are abused, it was happening. Yeah. But for me, you know, being 12, people ask me all the time, Rob, where'd you get that grit? Where did you get the grit? You know, that grit that you pull from within inside of yourself and move forward. And, you know, I have to tell you, it was that first night, you know, walking into that bathroom and seeing that bar of soap laying in the tub in my foster home and not really knowing what their favorite colors were and knowing at that moment in my life that these were strangers and that I had to make a decision. See, the fact that we all have to understand something, each and every one of us, whether we grew up in foster care, whether we grew up in a traditional home, whether we were adopted, no matter, we have 3 choices, and especially kids in foster care. Number 1, they have the choice to give up. You know, as I stood there in that bathroom, I'm not going to sit here and tell you, even as a 12-year-old boy, that I did not think about the fact that, you know, knowing that I've lost siblings to suicide, knowing that I've lost siblings to drug overdose, I could give up. Or number two, you can give in. You can give in and go down the exact road that the community expects of kids who have the F word in front of them. And I don't mean the dirty word. I'm talking about foster care. Yeah. And when I say give in, I can commit the petty crime. I can be the bad student at school. I can cause the problems that you all think that children in foster care do, that we are those bad kids. And I remind people, and I remind your listeners, is that children enter foster care because of choices other people make. They enter the system because of choices other people made. And then the third thing is you can give it all you got. And that's it. That night I decided I was going to be the kid to give it all I got. So I got out of the shower. I hung my towel up. I cleaned up the bathroom. I walked out into the living room and I proceeded to try to do everything I could to be a part of this family. Even when they would look at me and they would say, oh, these are my biological children and this is my foster child, I always wanted to make sure that I was a part of their family. And I would get up and do the dishes before anybody asked. I vacuumed the house before anyone asked. And the next thing you know, I'm 16, I'm 17, I'm a senior in high school, 1984. I will never forget it. I was making it. I couldn't believe it. First one in my family was going to graduate from high school. I was actually on the path of success. And I say that because I had a foster family that I felt at the time truly loved me. And so it was that fall of 84 when I came home from school. And there was that bag, the bag that I had not seen for years, my trash bag. And it was literally full with my belongings. And my foster father said, I can no longer live there. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, we're not getting the check anymore. He said, you're 18 years old now. The state's not paying us. And so you can't live here. And I remember looking at my foster mom, and I used to call her mom. And I was like, what do you mean? And a tear went down her eye. And she said, you can't live here. We're not receiving the check. And understanding, you know, foster care was not a walk in the park. My foster parents were very dysfunctional. My foster father was very abusive, but it was better than what I had come from. But then the next thing you know, I became homeless. And I literally lived on the streets my entire senior year of high school. I remember at the beginning, I would couch surf friends' houses, but you know, that got old after a while. And, you know, I had a $3.35 an hour job at the local taco place, and that was minimum wage. And, you know, they heard that I was the local homeless kid. And so they would leave the outside bathroom door unlocked for me to sleep there at night. And I'd spend my time in the public library and the mall and, you know, and going to school. And every day I would walk into school and I would pray that kids wouldn't push me in the locker, because I couldn't tell you the last time I had a haircut or brushed my teeth or showered and, you know, had holes in my shoes. But I just knew that if I got that piece of paper, if I got that education, that it would change my life. And I remember sitting in Mrs. Brown's English class, and I would watch the guidance counselor pull kids out to talk about their future, and no one would look at me. No one would acknowledge me. And I realized then that if you looked at me, if you acknowledged me, then you'd have to accept the fact that you failed me. You failed me. And that was so, so sad in my heart. But I made it. May of 85, I made it to graduation day, caps and gowns, and, you know, awesome. Walked across that stage as I listened to people scream and clap for all these other kids that were walking across. And then I walked across, and it was silence. No one clapped. No one cheered. Yeah. No one knew who I was. I truly was what my trash bag did. My trash bag defined me. I was invisible, and I was disposable. And that was hell.
You know, you mentioned, and I want to talk to you about what comes next, but you mentioned this idea of these are my natural children versus my foster child. And, you know, and as you know, we have two adopted girls. And when they were little, you know, there comes a time in an adopted parent's brain, at least in our brains, that, you know, that there was no difference, right? And so, you know, who does she look like? And that was always a point of difficulty for at least one of my two adopted girls, because, you know, they didn't know who they look like. The other two who are biological, they clearly look like Julie or myself or whatever. But this concept of adopted versus natural, always as a parent, it bothered me. And I'm going to assume that as a child, that sort of, I don't know if that had any impact on you, if that struck you when you were introduced as, here's my foster son, Rob, and these are my biological kids, yeah, or whatever their names were.
You know, it's I'm an adoptive dad of five children. I don't call them my adoptive kids.
Of course.
They're my children. Right? We actually haven't even finalized the adoption of our latest son. And, we don't talk about him as a foster kid because he still technically is. He's our son. And it did affect me as a young boy. It affected my identity because, yeah, I didn't look like them. And by the way, I have four kids of color, so they do not look like my husband and I.
Right.
But what we have done is we've raised our children to understand that each and every one of us are individuals. But we also, and this is something that not everybody agrees with us on, and that's okay, we're not all going to agree, but we also highlight the traits that each one of them have that are like their dad and I. So for instance, I have a son who is very outspoken like I am, who is the first one who wants to talk about changes within the world. And we are he is like cut out of the mold that I am. And then I have another son who is just like my husband, soft and gentle, mm-hmm, and quiet. And so we talk about those traits, that how much they're like, you know, each other.
But we do the same thing. This is why it's so impressive to me listening to you. My daughter Zoe, who's now a teacher in middle school, was always the one who was interested in movies and history and astronomy. My two biological girls were like, meh, you know, okay. But Zoe and I have always, ever since she was little, the joke was, you know, what's that? What's that? What's that? What's this? You know, that sort of thing. And we always had that connection. She may not have looked like me, like you're talking about, but there was that connection that was underneath the surface. And I think that as a parent, when you do that with your children, that's something they're going to remember and feel forever. And that's to borrow from my favorite musician, Bruce Springsteen, it's a tie that binds, you know, and it's a really neat thing.
It really is. You know, I was just interviewing someone on my podcast, and it was a author in Tel Aviv, and she was all about it. She wrote a book, it's about parenting. And mm-hmm, the thing that I took away from that is that if we raise each of our children as individuals, you know, it's like a tree. You know, you root them into the ground, but you understand that every single branch is different. And you, sure, and you actually acknowledge the difference of us, and not by the look, but by so many different things. I think it makes kids feel a lot more comfortable in their skin. At least it has for our five children. And by the way, David, I want to say something. People who've read my book, A Forever Family, or they've seen us on, you know, whatever TV show, the latest show we did with Bryce Howard and Will Smith, my oldest son has not been in any of the latest movies. And people don't realize that, you know, in 2019, my husband and I decided to bring a fifth child home, and we brought him all home at the age of 18.
That's fantastic.
And so we went from the gambit. Our baby arrived at 6 months. So literally my daughter Amaya and my son Makai arrived. They were two and they were four. 3 months later, my other two children arrived, and they were 6 months and two, all four. So they're two biological each. And then we fast forward 10 years later, and all of a sudden, my 18-year-old son arrives. So
that's fantastic.
We did the complete gambit of, you know, how kids coming into our home.
And I want to talk to you about the teenage years, and I want to talk to you about the transition. But before we move to comfort cases and that discussion, I know people out there want to know what happened next to you. So you go through graduation high school. So tell us what happened, how you got from there to being a banker and now to comfort cases. And I want to shift over to the foster care system.
Yeah, that was crazy. You know, I walked across that stage. I left that auditorium. I literally went back to the back parking lot and I sat down, and I remember like it was yesterday. And I remember sitting there and I remember starting to cry. And I was, you know, I had not cried a lot because I was, you know, I didn't want those emotions to well up inside of me, but I really cried. And I cried for my parents. I wanted to feel that cigarette on my leg so bad just because I would know that they were there. And then I cried for my foster parents because I was just like, how could they have given up on me after all of those years? You know, how could a check make a difference between love that, you know, when you love someone unconditionally, you know, there should never, ever be a reason to stop. And then I cried for all of you, my community. How could they have given up on me? And I remember I walked the streets for a couple of weeks. And when I was in school, it was, you know, I could go there for 8 hours a day, had a roof over my head. I could clean out as many trash cans as I wanted to find food. But when I really became homeless was when I was like, what the hell? I'll never forget it. I hitchhiked to Fort Meade, Maryland. I went on to the base and I said, I want to join the military. And I remember the front guard person saying to me, son, it doesn't work like that. And I was like, what do you mean? I want to be in the military. And he said, you got to find a recruiter and you have to take the ASVAB test. So it took a couple more weeks. And I did all of that. And I joined the United States Navy. And I joined the Navy. And that was my changing moment in my life. But when those who read my book will find out that for me, the Navy changed me, but it also broke me. Because after I had gone through boot camp, and by the way, I graduated as the honor man in boot camp, which is the highest honor you can get. I, you know, was in my A school and life was great. All of a sudden, I woke up in a hospital. And I will never forget the nurse walking in and saying, you know, seaman recruit, do you know why you're here? And I said, no, ma'am. And she said, we've had to reconstruct your bladder. And I said, what? And she said, yes. She said, you were sitting in class and you fell to the floor and you were rushed here to the hospital and the doctors had to reconstruct your bladder. See, when I was a little boy, my father used to punch us in our bladder and he would punch us. You know, anytime we went to the bathroom without asking, anytime that we would, you know, do something that he didn't like, and he would punch us. So I got to a point as a child that I didn't want to go to the bathroom because I was scared that I'd get punched. And even though that happened when I was a young boy, even as a teenager, I would still hold my urine as much as I could. And what happened was finally my bladder was just like, we can't do this anymore. And it ruptured. And so the Navy fixed me. They put me up in a hotel for 2 weeks on convalescent leave up in Chicago. And because I was in Great Lakes, Illinois, I went back to the base because I thought I was going to go to my A school and finish my A classes. And instead, Petty Officer Green looked at me and with a tear in his eye, because he knew my story. And he said, I don't know how to do this, but the Navy is making me discharge you. And I said, what? He says, we're not at a time of war. We're not at a time of need. And they feel that because of your medical condition, that you're more of a risk than you are a help. And they literally gave me a one-way plane ticket to Dulles Airport and 1 month pay. And I had literally missed the cutoff to be paid, you know, medical by like 45 days. And so I hitchhiked down Route 7 in Virginia and I found a hotel in a little town called Gore, Virginia, right outside of Winchester. They rented the hotels by the week, and I knew I had enough money, and I rented that hotel, and I hitchhiked into Winchester, and I got a job at this place. It was called Dart. It's like a Target nowadays. Back in
sure, Dart truck. Dart. Yeah, yeah.
Got a job there working part-time, and about 3 weeks into it, I realized that I was one more paycheck away from being homeless again, and I did what I had to do. I walked into the public library. I took a piece of paper. I put it into the typewriter. I grabbed a telephone book. And back those days, we actually had telephone books.
Yep.
And I proceeded to type up a resume. And I typed up a resume so good that you would have hired me, my friend. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the Salvation Army and I took the last couple of dollars I had and I bought a suit. And I then proceeded to walk into offices and apply for jobs. And I remember my palms sweating that I was going to get caught, that they were going to find out this resume was a lie and I was going to go to jail. And yeah. Instead, I walked into a bank and I applied for a position and the guy hired me. Lou Horowitz hired me and right on the spot. And that changed my life. I mean, 2 years into it, by that time, I'd moved into an apartment. I'd bought my first car. I'd started climbing the corporate ladder. But the guilt that I had from having that job based on a lie ate me like you would not believe. And I remember I walked into his office 2 years into that job and I handed him my letter of resignation. And I said, I can't stay. And he said, what is this? He was like, I tell you to come to work at 8, you get here at 6. I tell you to leave at 5, you stay till 8. He was like, you're the hardest worker that I have. And I said, remember that resume that I handed you? And when you first hired me, Lou? And he said, yeah. And I said, it was all lies. He was like, what? And I said, it was all lies. I made it up. I was like, I was days away from being homeless again. And I just couldn't do that. And he literally looked at me and he ripped up my resignation. And he said, you know, Rob, you are the hardest working person I've ever met. And you are the most honest. And he says, and I want you to do me one favor. I said, what's that? He says, I want you to get back to work. And that's what I did. And I climbed that corporate ladder as fast as I could. And the next thing you know, I was an executive. The next thing you know, I had learned so much about banking that I actually opened up my own mortgage company and did very well. Ended up selling it to a very large, large bank. I had offices all over the country. Life was good. And I will tell you, you know, I was... 13 years ago, before my babies arrived, I'm living in the city. I'm living in the big house and I had the expensive cars and I'm traveling the world because that's what my community taught me was all important.
Sure.
And then my children arrived and I was like, what the heck? I was like, none of this is important. None of it, you know? And what was important was just making sure that my children knew that they were loved. And, you know, I remember sitting in my office in Rockville, Maryland, and this was 10 years ago. And every year we would do these huge toy drives, and we were known for the toy drives. We were known, the Shears were known. I even actually have a picture hanging in Ben's Chili Bowl from my family from the toy drives that we would do at Ben's Chili Bowl. We would set up a tent. We would, you know, have WPGC come. We'd have local celebrities, all the politicians. We would collect thousands of toys. And this one particular year when my husband walked into my office and said, time to plan the toy drive. I said, I don't want to do it. And he says, what do you mean? I said, I don't want to do it. I said, what are we teaching our kids? You give the needy kid a toy and it makes our lives better. I was like, we know for those of us who celebrate Christmas that on the 26th of December, we wake up and we do not think about those children. And by the way, half of the toys are already broken. And he said, what do you want to do? And I literally opened up my desk drawer, and which, by the way, David, I have it in my desk drawer right now. I never go
anywhere. I know it's coming. Yeah.
I pulled out a trash bag.
Yeah.
And I laid it on my desk. And I said, Reese, I want to eliminate trash bags in foster care for DC kids and Maryland kids. And he literally said to me, you're crazy. I said, I know. That's why you married me. I said, we have to do it. I said, what are we teaching our children? What are we doing? Are we leading by example? Are we impacting our community as we are supposed to as leaders? And so I gathered members of our church together and my senior team and some of our friends, even some local politicians. And I stood up and I told my story for the first time. The story that I just told you about the kid who carried a trash bag back in the 70s. And how he decided that the bag was not going to define him, and how my children had arrived and carrying trash bags, and how that we as a community, and by the way, your community is not your zip code, it's our human race, but we as a community have failed so many children that we have to stop and stop now.
That's what I want to ask you about, Rob. That's where I really want to go with you right now, which is, and again, you have both lawyers and non-lawyers that are listening to this, and people with skills who understand how the courts work and so forth. Give us your sense of this, the system now, the issues that kids face now, and how we as either lawyers or lay people, whether here in the DC area or elsewhere, can help try to fix those problems that you see day in and day out working with your nonprofit.
You know, I have to tell you, I'm very open about my family and my story. And I have a son right now who suffers from what we call reactive attachment disorder. It is a very, very hard thing for any family to have a child with RAD. And the system has truly shown me even more today that it is even more broken than it was even 13 years ago when my first children arrived. And why I say that is because we have forgotten what child welfare is supposed to do. Very first goal is the fact that we need to be reunified with our children. That has to happen. We have to understand that 64% of all children who enter foster care because of the word neglect. The word neglect. But we also must understand that only 47% of children actually get reunified with their birth parents. So what we do as attorneys is, number one, we must advocate. We must advocate for the birth parents. We must advocate for the child. We must understand that a child is better off with a mother, okay, that gave birth to him, that we define, I mean, let me tell you, I go all over the country and I am shocked when I ask people the question, define neglect for me. Every county that I go to, every state that I go to, they have a different definition of neglect. Okay. And I'm going to give you a great example about this. About 2 years ago, we had this huge social media outburst that came out about the woman in Ohio. She wakes up at 2 o'clock in the morning. The baby will not stop screaming, stop crying. She has five kids, five dads, calls 911, says, you know, I don't have any formula in the house. I have no money. 911 dispatcher calls the police officer. Police officer goes to the store, buys formula, takes it to the mother, and everybody praises this police officer and this mother and how, oh, this is what community is supposed to do. Well, in that same year, that same exact year, a little girl at the age of 5, at 9 o'clock at night, when her mother, who works 2 jobs, fell asleep when she was reading her a book, got out of the apartment, walked outside to go across the street to her Nana's house. A police officer stopped the 5-year-old little girl and asked what you were doing on the streets at 9 o'clock at night. And she said, I'm going to my Nana's. And instead of that police officer walking her across the street and ringing the doorbell, he stuck her in the back of a police car and he took her to child welfare. And they put this kid in foster care. It took this mother almost a year to get her daughter back. And her daughter has never been the same. And by the way, she was Black. The woman in Ohio was white. I am telling you, my friend. We as attorneys must stand up and say enough is enough. We need to make sure that when children are removed from homes, that we have looked at every possibility before we move them. Number one, we need to look to see where is their other family members? Where are their other family members? That's the first thing that we have to do. And as attorneys, we have to fight for judges to do that. Number two, we have to look at how can we remove the perpetrator out of that home? Why should we disrupt the child? How can we remove the perpetrator from that home? Because normally in cases where we see the neglect that is happening, it is the neglect because of poverty level. Number three, how can we bring someone into the family to stabilize them? If you can take a child and you can put them in foster care and you can pay a foster parent anywhere from $700 to $1,200 a month, why can't we give that money to the family to provide the food that they need? The stress level that a parent has when they cannot provide for their child. We as attorneys, and I'm not an attorney, by the way, but I'm telling every single one because I deal with it every single day. We have.
Unfortunately, I'm sure. Yeah.
But we have to understand that we have such a power to sway the courts when it comes to our judges of, are we doing the right thing for the child, for the child.
You see, it's, you know, historically, and you know this probably better than I do, you know, the foster care system was born around the turn of the 20th century, right? Because before then, when the population was a lot lower, kids who had parents who were whatever they may be, they passed away, they were ill, they had left the children, they were in homes. Right. And so Congress back then and different states said, well, we should find a different way to help these kids. And so it seems to me, based on what you're saying, this is sort of a really good example of unintended consequences, right? The intention was to take care of these children and to find a better place for them. And now it sounds like what you're saying is that the plan to pull them away from their family, even though there may be other family members there, or there may be ways to improve their home life, has been overtaken by this, all right, they got to move to social services. There has to be an investigation. They have to go to foster care.
You know what, David, and you're exactly right. You hit the nail on the head, but we also must understand something. Child welfare, actually, foster care, actually, is an industry yeah, that makes money on the backs of children. And I'm telling you that when you have for-profit agencies, most of your listeners didn't even realize that those exist.
I'm sure they did.
They are for-profit agencies. Their whole entire existence is to keep that child as long as they can because the government's going to still pump that money into them for profit. No one should ever make a penny on the back of a child who has entered foster care because of a choice someone else made. Shouldn't happen, you know? And the problem is that foster care is not broken. We must understand that. Broken things, as my son would do, if something, one of his toys broke, he'd bring it to me and I'd grab the super glue and I'd put the super glue on and there it was fixed. Foster care is shattered. And when something is shattered, it has to be rebuilt. It has to be rebuilt. We cannot look at foster care the way we looked at it in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s. And by the way, we can't even look at it the way we looked at it in the 90s. You know, much less the early 200s. I mean, it is so unbelievably shattered. And the problem, mm-hmm, David, that I see is our probably the biggest issue is we don't do enough of what you and I are doing. We don't do enough of talking about it. Yeah. We don't do enough of pulling the Band-Aid off. Let me give you an example. Right here in our beautiful state of Maryland, the state that probably is voted one of the best states when it comes to care, when it comes to children in foster care. Let me tell you how great this state is. Young boy gets taken from his parents because he is mentally ill and he states that there was an abuse and neglect happening. Investigation happens. at first they take the boy, they put the boy in a therapeutic foster home. Investigation happens, finds no grounds. Child never been spanked, never been neglected, totally loved. Interview doctors and therapists and teachers and nannies and friends and siblings. And this boy is mentally ill. But still, the system keeps him in this therapeutic foster home because there's got to be something there. Because why would this boy say this at the age of 11? Well,
doesn't that require training? I mean, it really
no, that's the bull crap about this. Yeah. So then it even gets better. Therapeutic foster family, because they're therapeutic. And what child in foster care isn't therapeutic? Receiving money. 6 months in, the adopted parents are fighting for their son. Closed adoption. Next thing you know, adopted parents hire a private investigator. They believe that there's something more going on. And guess what that adopted parent uncovered? That the entire time that their son was living in this therapeutic foster home, the boy was actually living at his biological mother's house, where she had had a TPR, which for those who are listening, that is when you terminate the parent's rights, where she's had 33 charges in the last 10 years, where her child came into the system because of bleeding of the brain, shaken baby syndrome, and 3 broken ribs. And this therapeutic foster parent allowed this child to be living in a birth parent, even though there was a court order of no contact. And let me tell you what happened to this therapeutic foster parent. The child was removed from that home and placed in another place, and he was slapped on the wrist and said, "You know that's not for what you should be doing." And still, he receives his monthly check. That's how bad our system is.
It's just awful. And I'm not sure when you talk about the system being shattered and they have to be put back together again or start from scratch. Really, you move one puzzle piece and another one falls off the table, right? I mean, doesn't it really start with educating? Well, first of all, I guess policing where this money is going and how it's getting there, but also educating folks. I mean, anyone who's been involved who understands adoption understands that my adopted daughter is my daughter.
Yes.
Somebody else might have had the baby or deposited the sperm to have the baby, but that's my kid. And that person, it's not biology at that point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree.
It's connection.
I agree.
And so there you have someone who has no sense, therapeutic or otherwise, and how this person's working in a therapeutic foster home is a question, I guess, and another rabbit hole to go down.
You know, and you're so right about that. And the fact is that that's just one of thousands and thousands and thousands of stories that I hear throughout the country. And it's happening time and time again. We have forgotten the fact that children are there because someone else made a choice. For that boy, he's there because a court made a choice. An attorney made a choice. You know, they didn't look to see what's the best for that child. You know, and we see that all the time. You know, I truly do believe that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I believe that the light at the end of the tunnel is pulling the Band-Aid off child welfare, letting people know how this $3 billion industry is truly being ran and how that there is no accountability for money whatsoever. And, you know, look at my son. Look at my oldest son who arrived in the system. You know, I mean, at 18, he arrived in my home with nothing. Come on. And then when, you know, he turned 21 2 weeks ago, what did the state of Maryland give him? A check for $300 and said, good luck. Are you kidding me? You wonder why our prison systems are filled with kids from foster care? You wonder why that 80% of our gang members are from foster care? Because we fail them. These kids deserve to be set up for financial success. And by the way, if you can pay a foster parent, then there's no way in hell you cannot take a bit of that money and put it in an interest-bearing savings account for these children when they arrive in the system. And number two, we have to understand that children, just because they turn age of 18, does not make them adults. Does not make them adults. They still need love. They still need foundation. They still need wraparound services. They still need the education pathways opened up. They still need to know that they belong to you. They belong to me. They belong to us. To us. They are our future. And if we do not invest in them today, every one of your listeners will have to invest in them tomorrow, because the only thing we keep doing is building more prisons, my friend, building more prisons.
Rob, what can folks do themselves? I mean, you know, the average bear of us is, you know, we're working and taking care of our kids and goes on our vacation and worries about our own things. Here's you talking about this, and it strikes a chord, right? But it strikes a chord today, and you want it to strike a chord tomorrow and the next day and so forth. And what, in the little corners of the world that we all live in, what can each of us as individuals, do you think, do to try to help this cause and help these issues that we've been talking about?
Well,
today?
First of all, we have to understand that each and every one of us are doers. And that is the reason the world goes around, because of doers. We're pushing that world to spin because we're doers. And every one of us have the ability to do. It doesn't matter what your skin color is. It doesn't matter your sexual orientation. It doesn't matter how much money's in your pocket. Every single one of us have the most valuable thing in the world. And that is our time. Our time. So what the first thing that they need to do is find organizations that support these kids, such as comfortcases.org and so many others throughout the country. Find the local group home and go mentor. You know, go shoot some ball with these kids. Go sit down and help them with their homework. Go let them know that, you know what, I am here for you. And by the way, in the beginning, of course, they're going to push you away, because we've done nothing but disappoint them time and time again. You know, but you have the ability. Become a CASA, a court-appointed special advocate. They are the best people in the world. Become a CASA. You know, there's all you can do, but continue to volunteer when it's truly making an impact for your community. And I will say, children in foster care are truly where we need to all be standing next to, because they are the ones that we're making an impact.
And Rob, if someone wants to help you, contact your organization directly and try to pitch in, or get some ideas or direction, what's the best way for them to do that?
You know what? They can visit our website at comfortcases.org. That's comfortcases.org. We are an international nonprofit. Understand, we're 96% volunteer ran. We have delivered now over 165,000 cases to all 50 states, DC, Puerto Rico. And in 2020, we actually opened up a center in the United Kingdom, because there's 84,000 kids in foster care who are carrying trash bags there as well. So this isn't just something that's happening in the United States, my friend. This is happening all over the world. And as I said earlier, understand something, each and every one of you, that you must realize that your community is never, ever, ever your zip code. Your community is our human race. And what affects someone in my little town of Darnestown, Maryland, affects someone in Austin, Texas. And what affects someone in Austin, Texas, affects someone in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We must all come together and demand that children in foster care are treated like every other child, with dignity, with respect, and with hope.
Now, Rob, you also host your own podcast where people can listen in and learn about these issues directly on a more regular basis. How would they do that? What's the name of the podcast?
Yes, we do. You know, I'm in my third season of Fostering Change. It's on all the podcast platforms, and it's actually a video podcast on YouTube as well. And I am so, so absolutely grateful to my team, because in 2021, we were voted the number one podcast when it comes to adoption and foster care. Tune in every Tuesday, and we talk about every topic you can imagine when it comes to helping children and helping our communities be better humans. Because at the end of the day, each and every one of us, that's what we need to do. Be a good human.
Sounds like a good place to start, Rob. It really does. That's comfortcases.org for those of you listening out there, and the Fostering Change podcast that Rob hosts every Tuesday. I want to thank everybody out there for listening. Rob Scheer, thank you so much for joining us. We hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. Listen in on our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.